I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome back to Close Reads here on the Close Reads Podcast Network. I am David Kern, and as always, I am joined by my old friends Heidi White and Tim McIntosh. Just to be clear, they're not actually old people. They're just, we've been friends for a long time.
Yes.
They're older than me, though. I should make that clear.
Just a little bit, by
6 months.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then a year
not much.
For me older.
You did tell me last summer at the conference, David, that...
I do not even want to know what I said.
You did say that you, in soul and spirit, were older than me. And I've held on to that.
I said that about myself?
Yes.
Was I trying to compliment you or was I talking myself?
No, I think you were complimenting me. That's how I took it, at least.
I love it.
If I have a chance to interpret something positively towards me, I will.
Yeah, I honestly have no idea what I meant at this point. I'm sure I was trying to be nice or something. Hopefully, I wasn't trying to like puff myself up. But speaking of puffing ourselves up, we have, before we get into the show today, and we talk about how people can get in touch and everything, we have a group of, I don't really know how to put it, other than super fans, like, the Jocos readers group are friends that are like, I'm kind of at a loss for words because they knew that everything going on with the COVID-19 and all that has, impacted our business and our finances a little bit. And so they kind of got together and they wanted to help us raise some funds. And it's incredibly generous and they're doing almost all the work, but they asked us to do some fun stuff. Like, we're going to, if someone wants to, we will leave the voicemail on their phone and we're going to do a Zoom lunch where a couple of you can have lunch with Tim and Heidi and I as we, talk about nonsense and whatnot. And, you have a chance to choose a book for the show or choose a story or a poem for an episode. There's a bunch of things like that. And, we're going to, post this on the Close Reads newsletter. So if you go to closereads.substack.com or on the Instagram page, you'll be able to get access to this information. I think we're going to post this probably later this week. But one of the things that they did, Heidi, you can go ahead and text this to Tim, because they commissioned...
Oh my gosh, I'm so curious right now.
They commissioned one of our... the people who works for us, Casey Rufato, she's an artist. She does lino cuts and printmaking and stuff like that. And without us knowing... They commissioned Kirsty to do this image of the three of us that they made into posters.
Whoa!
So we just sent it to Tim. Tim has never seen it before. They wanted it to be a surprise.
Whoa!
So Kirsty did this.
Oh my goodness!
Well, I'll let Tim describe it to you.
So it's a woodcut. Is that what it is?
A lino cut. Yeah. It's not wood.
And it's the three of us with the Close Reads banner overhead. Heidi in the middle, gosh, if you're David on the right and me on the left. It's great. I don't even know how to describe it. I had no idea she was so talented. Why have I not seen this from her? It's
She's
so
amazing.
Good.
So we're publishing. We're publishing a book called 30 Poems to Memorize, parentheses, before it's too late, end parentheses. And she, we had this idea to have her do lino cuts of paintings or illustrations or whatever of all the poets that are in it. And so her lino cuts are actually going to be in the book. And if you have seen the page for the Close Reads retreat that we were going to do on Wendell Berry, or hopefully we are doing at some point, it's just a matter of the date. She had done one for us on Wendell Berry for that event. And so when I saw that, Graham and I were like, you have to do this for the book. So then I guess people saw that she had this skill and went to her and said, you need to do this of the people. I don't really even know what the Jocos people are doing is friendship of the highest order, trying to support the show. And they raise some money to pay for the printing of these posters. And then also they raised some money to pay for the printing of some new t-shirts that Graham designed specifically for this. So you'll see those as well.
No way.
With a kind of special 1990s, 1980s children's literature TV theme. Just put it that way. So if you, wow. When you see that, you'll love that. So it's incredibly generous and we're so grateful. And yeah, I just wanted to say publicly thank you and, you know, publicly give Tim a chance to be shocked on air. Our favorite thing to do is...
It's really remarkable.
Yeah.
It's amazing. I just love, here's three things I love. David's shirt. Like, that's my favorite part.
Sweater? Like the striped shirt?
Yes. Yeah. Because like you own that. And I think it's so great. I also love Tim's like collar, the way it's like lying.
I think it's it's just a mess.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is accurate.
Yes. And that's my real cross that she put on my neck that was taken from a Bolshevik refugee and it was sold in Latvia many years later.
Oh, wow.
And was given to me as a Christmas present by my best friend. And so she put that actual cross on my neck in this picture. So it's just the details amazing and the love that went into this from so many people. And I finally have a poster. So
That's true.
That's what's Jesse, important right now. So I'm just kidding.
Jesse Brown asked us to describe the close readers.
Yeah.
Like there was a handful of questions that she asked, you know, like in
Jesse spearheaded a lot of
private messages. Yeah.
She's incredible.
And I don't even know. I mean, she said describe close reads and then describe basically the close reads listenership. And I don't even know how to describe them. I mean, I don't even know what to say even right now. It's the most wonderful group of friends that I've met. Some of them, but most of them I've not met yet.
Yeah, just online.
And they like shower us with these kindnesses. Like this is another example. And they're thanking us for, you know, what we do on Closers. I'm like, wow. We're the ones, like, I feel like we should be the ones thanking you guys. I just don't, seriously, it makes me really emotional. I'm so touched by like the outpouring of generosity and affection that just seems to like take root in some new way, like every week being on this show.
It's moving. It's special. This is a special community.
Yeah.
It really is. It's, of the many things that I like the most, I mean, honestly, like receiving coffee from a close reader, just for the sheer kindness of sending coffee from Costa Rica, his family in Costa Rica sent it. I just like, it fills me with so much delight. Yeah. The other thing that I love is just that there's this like incredible balance of like inquiry and curiosity and like tough questions about the books that we're reading, coupled with this just kindness and generosity. And to be part of a community that has both of those things at the same time is like being in heaven.
Hmm. You know, I was thinking yesterday about how so since all this COVID-19 stuff has been going on, I have sort of distanced myself from social media just for my own mental health. And I check in on, I don't get on Facebook or Twitter at all except for work purposes. And by work purposes, I mean to get on the Close Reads group and, you know, post stuff or just check in on what's going on and make sure no one has asked me for something. But I always check in and I genuinely miss the conversation there. But I always, you know, when I check in and then I realize, you know what? I'm not needed. That community is so...
It just runs
great.
Itself.
It runs itself. People have so many great things to say and there's so much wisdom on it. So, you know, we love being a part of it and we love doing the show and all that. But you guys, you know, all of you who are listening and talking on there, like you're the heartbeat of it. And, you know, truly like, you know, people ask me for stuff. I can get information. I can send links, you know, we'll produce the podcast and stuff. But that community online and especially in the Jocos super group, that doesn't need us to be, you know, what it is. You guys make that what it is.
right,
just as much as this podcast does. And you know, we love, like I said, we love producing the podcast, and you know, we're here for you and all that. We're going to keep producing content, but you know, that thing has taken, that group has taken on a life of its own that is independent, maybe not independent of us, but
yeah, despite it's theirs,
despite it's cool. Y'all's. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah,
and we're not even invited.
Yeah, and yeah, we're not even invited in the super group. The super group. Yeah, I said super fans earlier because that's what Jesse likes to call it. She says they call themselves, that she, or at least she calls them super fans. But I do. You know, I realized this week that you know, it's a good thing that I'm married, because you know, I was telling Bethany about all this, and she's gonna, you know, this might be one of those things she'd get mad at me for saying, but you know, she's like, she like rolls her eyes at it all. She's like, why would anybody want to post her? I mean, she says it in a very joking way. You know, she's not being serious or being mean or whatever.
Right.
It's like, she just like rolls her eyes. And I, maybe 90% of her rolling her eyes at me is just to keep me humble, you know? but you know, like, you know, just when, you know, someone does something nice, it's like, I said that thing about the group, because in some ways it is easy to be like, maybe we're doing something really great, but it's, you know, what we're doing is we're talking about books and we're doing things we love anyway. And,
yeah,
you know, as Tim said, we feel like we should be thanking you guys. So anyway, yeah, y'all are incredible. The listeners that we have are so engaged and so kind, and wouldn't trade, you know, the 10,000 of you or whatever the number is, depending on the episode, for like 100,000 that listen to some other podcasts but aren't as generous and kind people, you know, so.
True.
David, true, can I say one more thing before we talk about Anne? I took a class in rhetoric at the University of Oregon a few years ago. And the best definition of rhetoric that I heard in all of these different kind of like discussions about what Plato thought and what Aristotle thought was from a contemporary scholar. And she said, she basically flipped rhetoric on its head. So instead of like Aristotle, Plato, you know, rhetoric is about the various powers of persuasion coming from the speaker. This scholar said rhetoric is actually the proximity that the listener, like the fellow, the conversation partner, puts himself in regard to the speaker. And that stuck with me so much. And I think, so rather than like the power of the person who's doing the speaker, it's the willingness of the person or the people who are listening to put themselves in close proximity with the speaker so that they understand and engage and have sympathy with. And I was like, wow, that really fits close reads. I mean, hopefully we have thoughtful things to say every once in a while, and we're inspired by these incredible books that we're reading. But I'm just going to try to echo your point, David. I just really feel like the proximity with which this community has stood toward us, like that they've walked closer to us, makes the show. Just makes the show.
Yeah. I got a message, a couple messages from people, you know, after I brought the Daily Poem back. I'd been off kind of on a hiatus for about a month while I was trying to figure out, you know, how to do it and get my life in some semblance, like figure out what my new routine was going to be for this little while here. And then I got a couple messages from people saying, we're so glad you brought it back. And at first I was like, that's great. They, you know, people are really excited for it. And then I got a message that was very kind, but it was something like, you know, this is a time when of all times we need to be reading poetry. And I felt a little bit, you know, chastened, like, you know what, that person's right. Like, you know, there's so much, what I'm trying to say is there's so much wisdom out there. And I feel not just that we are able to offer, you know, hopefully encouraging or thoughtful things about the books and the literature and all that, but there's so much wisdom from people who are causing us to learn things as well. And I know that all the time, you know, you just see it on a Q&A episode. So often the three of us talk about how, well, whatever this person said was so interesting and it caused us to change the way we were thinking about something. So it's not just that people are kind and generous, but that people out there are genuinely thoughtful as well and participating in the conversations that we're having and inspiring the conversations that we're having. So that's the part that, in addition to the things we're saying, that part also has stood out to me over the last several months and weeks. So anyway, we are here to talk about Anne of Green Gables. Heidi, did you want to add anything else? Tim and I just got to, you know, wax ineloquently for a few minutes.
No, I just echo that. It's remarkable. And I think what is one of the most special things about the community, with the loyalty and the generosity, is also how how much of a reading community it is for us as well. I learn so much from these people and think so much more deeply as a result of the conversations that we have. It isn't that there's the three of us and then this fan group. It's that we are all in a long-term conversation about books. And the longer that this group goes on, it becomes a group of friends, a group of reading friends. And it's incredibly unique and special. I really, truly don't know anything like it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there are other groups. Yeah, there are probably other groups that are like it, but you know, it's unique in my life for sure.
Probably not. This is the one. No, I'm just kidding.
No, listen, there's probably a Sparkjack group out there that is super close and very tight, and you know, I'm sure it's out there. The internet is a big place.
It's a big place. That is the truth.
Well, we are here to talk about chapters 28 through 32 of Anne of Green Gables. If you want to become a part of this conversation, you can head over to Facebook, search for Close Reads in the search bar, and the discussion group will pop up. Click that join button, and we will welcome you with open arms, as well all these other people we're talking about. You can also follow us on Instagram at Close Reads Pods, and then we have the newsletter, which is closereads.substack.com. And if you'd like to email us directly, you can email us at closereadspodcasts@gmail.com. If you want to get our bonus episode and support the show a little bit, you can go over to patreon.com/closereads. And there's some sweet show swag there, as well as the bonus episodes, which are currently ongoing on Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. New episode of that is actually going up today. Tim and Heidi I wasn't there, but apparently they had a great conversation. So we'll, you know, they say it was good. So until we hear otherwise from the listeners, we'll go with that. but let's talk about Anne of Green Gables. We're nearing the end. Next week is actually the episode where we talk about the final chapters, the denouement, the conclusion of Lucy Maud Montgomery's novel. And then the week after that, we will do a Q&A. So get your questions ready and we'll try to answer some of them. But here we have the, you know, this section began with what Heidi says is her favorite episode, the favorite little story within the story, where Anne is, you know, playing Elaine, right? And she's her boat springs a leak and she's rescued by the gallant knight Gilbert, who she then rejects, and a merry war, you know, ensues. And then they go and they study their test, and a couple of years pass, and at the end of it she has passed the test. So to me, this is a section where the story, for some reason, the story begins to deepen. It might be that she's maturing a little bit, and there's a sort of nostalgia that's setting in, a sort of sadness that's setting into the novel. And Heidi, I want to give you a chance to talk about the boat springing a leak section. But before we do that, I want to ask Tim whether you feel that same way, Tim. Having read this for the first time, did this section feel like the book was changing for you?
For sure. And I'll say I was aided in that conviction because I'm listening to it on Audible, and the woman who's reading it, it's a really excellent performance. She actually changes Anne's voice a little bit in, I think it was chapter 31. Like there's a paragraph, I should have highlighted it, that talks about kind of how Anne is talking less, and Marilla asks her why, and she says that she prefers to kind of like keep her thoughts inside. So anyway, during that section, the actual voice of the woman playing Anne drops just a little bit. It has a more mature quality for it. And I think I would have picked up on it anyway because of that paragraph where Lucy Maud Montgomery makes it really clear, like, yeah, there's been this maturation process in Anne. But I was aided by that audible performance.
So one of the things you talked about is how much delight you took in Anne's sort of story and her growth and her adventures and her personality.
Yeah.
Does the, you know, her growing up and this sort of nostalgia and this, you know, bit of sort of sadness in her becoming a young adult, does that change your experience with the book? Does it make you delight in it less?
Well, it makes me sad. I mean, it makes me sad. I mean, I have this feeling. When Gutenberg graduated a class, you know, Gutenberg College was such a small place that we knew, the professors knew our students really well. and we would have a graduation ceremony, and then we would have a reception afterwards. And it was, people would make a joke that every year I would go to the reception and I would kind of duck out early. And people would say, like, where did you go? You know, I would say my goodbyes to the students and then I would leave early. And people would say, what? Where did you go? Why did you leave early? And I was like, I'm so sad. I don't want to, I'm just so sad that everybody's growing up and leaving. And it's what we are here for, is to, you know, help them move on past Gutenberg.
Yeah.
But it's a very sad moment. I'm sure it's like what parents feel when their kids leave the home. You know, they go off to college or they move out for the first time. It's just unhappy. And I feel like that's beginning with Anne, especially with the prospect of maybe she's going to go to school if she does well on her exams. Gosh, it's all about a change. And it affected me. I was sad about it.
So Heidi, it seems to me then that this famous boat springing leak scene that you, we should probably come up with a better name for it than the boat springing leak scene. But the famous boat springing leak scene, it actually seems to come at this transitional point. You know, like it's seen in some ways to be the last childlike adventure episode that she has as it leads into these, you know, this quick passage of time where she's growing up and she's changing. Do you think that has anything to do with why you particularly love it?
Oh, that's a good question. It probably does, but I hadn't put that together before. I think it is a transitional scene. There's a symbolism to it. There's this objective correlative of kind of the boat of her romanticism springing a leak, and she has to actually live in reality. So I'm sure that does. Also, her resistance, her spurning of Gilbert, the true knight, this is a low point for her. This is a flaw in Anne that's not delightful. And I think that's important to the story too.
That's interesting that you connect the sort of, she has to live in reality and the sort of, how did you put it? Like her romance was sort of being shot.
Springing a leak. Yes. Yeah.
Shot through with reality and then began to leak. Yeah. So, it's interesting that you say that. And then in that moment, she then rejects the sort of, the true knight. So, you know, she would have always read all these stories where, you know, you have this damsel in distress and the true knight comes along and rescues her and, you know, happily ever after and so forth. And when she is in the moment when she needs that, her pride gets in the way of her being able to accept that knight. Mm-hmm. And, you know, do you think that this is a point where the book is saying what it really thinks about that romance? Or is it just that Anne, that it's truly an example of like her pride more than anything?
That's a really good question. One thing I like about Montgomery is that she does, I think, a good job, particularly in this book, of showing versus telling about Gilbert and Anne. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more as Anne develops. I mean, this exact same thing happens in a different context later on in her life, in which she continues to hold on to her romantic ideal versus welcoming as a friend and then as a lover this her true knight. And this plays out over and over again in her life. And when she has an opportunity to humble herself and let go of pride and her vanity and her false idealism and actually embrace the true reality to become real, like Velveteen Rabbit, right? And she does reject that in a more serious tone later. And Montgomery kind of puts it a little bit more in our face what she's doing than she does here. In some ways, this is still some foreshadowing of the future, but it's still very real to Anne. And I love the fact that he literally rescues her when she's in this state of dreamy abstraction and stuck in her head. And then he comes and saves her, and she can't see it still.
Mm. Yeah.
And it's funny and charming, but it's also like real. That's serious.
What do you mean that she can't see it? She can't see that she is stuck in this world of abstraction, or she can't see the good in Gilbert, or what do you mean?
Both. I guess I mean both, but I was specifically talking about Gilbert. And then later Jane says to her, "Oh, Anne, how splendid of him. Why, it's so romantic. Of course you'll speak to him after this." "Of course I won't," flashed Anne with a momentary return of her old spirit. "And I don't ever want to hear the word romantic again, Jane Andrews." And that's funny. And at this point, there's not much at stake, but there comes a time when there is. And Anne is still, she says, "I don't want you to mention the word romantic again," when something actually romantic has happened to her.
Yeah.
And Anne really can't see it because she's stuck in her head holding on to her own idea of what romanticism is. When her boat's literally just sprung a leak. Yeah. So it's actually, I mean, it is a funny, charming scene, and we don't have to read too much into it, but it's on a craftsman level, it really is kind of brilliant. Like, she's in this boat, it springs a leak, and that's a very symbolic kind of thing.
Well, I would love to have been able to talk to Lucy Maud Montgomery about how she crafted this book, because, you know, like, I wonder if she had a notebook. She had this character in mind, and then say she had a notebook. Did they have notebooks back then? Let's say she had a notebook. Maybe she was carving on tree bark. And she was like making a list of all the adventures Anne could have. And I wonder if she actually thought, this one should happen when she's younger, and I'll make it much more of a, you know, 10-year-old type adventure. And then this one should happen when she's 14 or something, and it should be a transitional one. And so I wonder, I would love to know if she actually planned out for this one to be the transitional moment into where for us as readers, it's the last sort of childlike adventure, and where the true conflict with Gilbert meets a head in that moment. I just would be very curious to know how she thought about that. Because in the movie, Tim, you might even remember this from all the times you watched the movie by osmosis. in the movie, didn't they make the moment where he rescues her the moment where she finds out that she passed the test? Because in the book, she gets a letter or something. But in the movie, doesn't Gilbert tell her that they passed? And then she says, "Oh, well, you obviously came first." And he says, "No, we tied." I feel like the book combined the two scenes into this.
Do you know, Heidi? I don't.
I do know. Those are two different. They are two different scenes. Okay. He tells her that,
doesn't he?
Yeah. But what I find interesting is that you've conflated them. Like, to you, they're like, your memory of it is that that's kind of the same moment, has the same weight of meaning to it, right?
But in the book, in the movie, though, it is Gilbert who tells her, though, right, that she passed.
Yes. Well, he tells her that she wins the Avery Scholarship.
Is that later?
Yes.
Okay.
Wait, she wins the Avery Scholarship?
What?
Okay. All right. I'm way off. Never mind. Maybe we can just talk about something else. Move on now.
My memory is W-U-T? Not. W-U-T? What?
I don't know what you heard. But
you know what? Honestly, I was like, I've already had this thought. When she finds out via the newspaper, I was like, how are we going to afford this? We can't afford it. Matthew will find a way. Matthew will find a way. But now I know the Avery Scholarship.
Well, I screwed that up for you. So really, Heidi was the one that told you. But
it was me.
Heidi, I'm blocking it from my memory.
Said the wrong things. This girl.
No, I literally just said the wrong things. I said like literally the wrong thing was true. Now I guess I need to go watch the movie again. Tim, do you think you'll watch this movie again? The miniseries, now that you've once you finish the book?
I kind of have this daydream that when I'm next in Atlanta, I'll like get my sister to watch one of the episodes with me. Because I've been telling her offline, I've been like, "Chris, we're doing Anne of Green Gables," and I remember like stumbling downstairs and, you know, seeing you watch this show and rolling my eyes. And now I'm like just so enjoying this book. And she says, I'm so sorry that I subjected you to Anne of Green Gables. And I was like, I didn't subject you to 100 Chicago Bulls games in the 1990s, you know, like yeah. That knife cut both ways, girl.
Yeah. That's called being brother and sister. Exactly. Is she younger or older than you?
Younger by 2 years.
Okay. Oh, okay.
But more talented, professional, capable in, I think, every way. Yeah, every way.
She must be pretty talented then.
Nice reply. Mm. Well done. Well done.
All right. Well, let's keep talking about Anne of Green Gables since that's what the people are here to listen to. Where were we?
So this change that's taken place in Anne, and the big question for most of this section is whether or not she is going to pass her exams and whether her cohort is going to, they're going to pass their exams. And that was a great section. I loved the section. We get to know the personalities of her cohort a little bit better. Wait, by the way, I had this question. I'm going to derail us for a second.
Go ahead.
So when Diana finds out, so there's this scene where Anne finds out that Miss Stacy has asked her to be part of this, I'm calling it a cohort, you know, like it's a grad school thing, part of this cohort that meets after classes end, and they're going to prepare to take this exam. And Anne is heartbroken that she and Diana are going to be separated. And I was reading it and I thought, gosh, when is the jealousy going to kick in from Diana? Because this is now like a rivalry. And no jealousy kicked in. And I thought, man, maybe I'm just doing this sort of, I had this sort of masculine expectation that any sort of event like this would cause a rivalry. And maybe I just have like this very masculine vision of friendship. I'm sure that I do. Like, I think one of the oldest books that human beings have a copy of begins with a male rivalry that turns into friendship. The Epic of Gilgamesh is this battle between Gilgamesh and Enkidu. They can't defeat each other. So what happens? They become best friends. And like, it's the story of their friendship and, you know, the loss of Enkidu. And I think of so many friendships that I've had, like begin with just sort of like a spark of competition, whether it be verbal competition or athletic competition or what have you. And then it gradually moves into like this deep respect that becomes this bond. And I thought, yeah, Tim, this is not the story that you're reading. This is Diana and Anne are, this is not the kind of ground that they're walking on. But was I the only person who expected that there might be some sort of like a little rivalry that blossomed between Diana and Anne? I really want to know, Heidi, what you think. Can you remember back to an early reading?
I read this book before the girl drama years.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
When I hit the girl drama years, I was floored by it.
Floored by what?
The drama. Like I really was. When I hit like the fifth, sixth grade years.
The drama that you were living through, not the drama in the book.
Yeah.
That may, okay,
because
yeah.
Because I thought that my friendships were going to be like Anne and Diana's. And so I specifically remember standing on the playground and a girl having just been really cruel to me that I thought was my friend, and I wanting to cry because, and thinking to myself, I thought we were going to be like Anne and Diana.
Yeah.
So there was this expectation that was formed. Mm. And I think every girl kind of goes into those years. I don't want to speak for every girl. That's probably, I think most women I know remember those years very vividly. And there is a sense of competition. Usually it's competition over different things. It's not necessarily always who gets on the basketball team or whatever, or who gets the best grades. There's kind of a different currency in feminine circles than there is in masculine ones, from what I can tell, but it's there. And it's just as cruel and just as vicious and just as front and center. Mm. And it is left out of the Anne books. And I think that's one of the ways in which it's maybe least realistic or true to childhood.
Yeah, I was going to ask you.
One of the ways that it's, I think, really sweet to read.
Yeah.
So then it being left out, do you think that it's just like Lucy Maud Montgomery was like, I just don't care about that kind of thing. I want to leave it out. Do you think things were just different in the early 1900s? Do you think that there was something in the water in Prince Edward Island? Do you think that, like, for her, it was that these two characters are of a certain sort of character that they would be able to persist in their friendship and that jealousy would not set in, like in terms of the characters of Anne and Diana, that they're so committed to one another and that their personalities and their character are such that would not be a problem and thus it wasn't necessary to put in the story? Or do you think that she was trying to make some kind of like a point or about things being more pleasant? Or was it just truly not as bad in, you know, 1910 in Prince Edward Island?
Right. I don't know the answer to that. I thought about that. And I think that this, to me, is where the question of escapism comes in the most, is the dynamic of the relationships at this stage of life. You know, we talked about whether or not Anne's imagination was kind of an escapist trope in the novel. And I said no to that. But I do often wonder if it is, in the friendships between the girls and the story, if that's kind of a bit of wish fulfillment on Montgomery's part. Mm. And just, she is portraying an idealized childhood at this point. I think that, you know, the meanness and the pettiness are like these outsider characters, the Gertie Pye and Josie, are petty and they gossip and blah, 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 but not these friends of Anne's, not Ruby and Jane and Diana. These girls are, in a sense, I think, idealized. And I don't know that I think that that's a bad thing, because I do think this is a book that is attempting to portray an idealized, intentionally idealized vision of childhood, a what could be kind of vision of childhood. And I think that there's something really wholesome and healthy about that, but I'm not sure I think that it's super realistic for 11-year-old girls.
So then does that mean that what we're getting here is a transitional point out of that sort of idealized what could be, you know, wish fulfillment section into a more a sort of more realistic approach to storytelling and to these characters? Or does that wish fulfillment sort of persist through the other books?
It remains. There's a very idealized vision for female friendship in these novels. And like I said, I don't know that I think that that's bad. I don't know that I think childhood stories need to be super, every single one of them needs to be realistic. I don't really want to see, you know, Diana stomping out the door and saying, you get all the attention. Everybody likes you more than me and you're smarter than me and you have every, you know, like that's.
Or creating a gossip campaign against Anne,
right?
Like, which would be worse in some way.
Yes. So female friendships are very idealized in these novels all the way through. And I kind of like it that way.
I'm thinking, so a more realistic way to handle it while retaining the idealism could be something like this. Diana is not selected for the after-school studying. And she, because her friendship with Anne is so crucial, she goes to Anne and she, you know, voices a complaint against her, or she, you know, just expresses how disappointed she is and how much she feels left out. And then the two girls kind of patch it up. They talk it out and they patch it up, and their friendship moves forward. Heidi, do you think that if some episode like that was included, that the kind of, that the moral power of the story, because I think it is, it's not just a story of Delight and of Green Gables, but it does seem like it's also, it is kind of a moral tale. I mean, I think Anne is careful to kind of like warn the reader. That's not really the point of this story, just like it's not the point of my stories. Yeah, I kind of, I have a moral in the end. But nevertheless, I do think that there's a kind of like a moral ideal aspect of this book. And if there was like a little bit of like realistic psychology between the two girls, and they actually, instead of just, instead of Lucy Maud Montgomery glossing over this potential problem of jealousy, instead of, if she actually had the two girls argue with it, do you think it would diminish the kind of moral power of the story that we're reading?
I think it would change the character of Anne and Diana. It's a good question. I'm not sure exactly how to answer it because it's so firmly fixed in my mind as what it is.
Yeah.
I guess I just have to answer it from my preference, in the sense that I love the idealized vision for relationship in this novel. Whether it would be, the moral power would be diminished in some ways, I think it would, because one of the whole points of this is, what if we really lived like this?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And there's a great depth of sorrow that and loss that comes into Anne's life, into all of these characters' lives as they mature and become adults. And yet one of the anchors for them is community, faith, and friendship. And so to kind of make, to weaken those ties is to me equivalent of saying, what if, you know, would it diminish the power of the story if Jaber Crow decided to move to New York City and start a barbershop there because he could make more money?
Yeah.
Yes, because yeah, that's the whole point of the book.
Right.
The whole point of the book is the power of place. And in the Anne of Green Gables series, the whole point of the book is, and I, is the redemptive potential for community, for relationship, for faith, for an ordinary life. And so it intentionally is portraying an idealized vision of human relationship, the same way that Wendell Berry is intentionally portraying an idealized, that's with great, ordinary Heidi, kind of problems of life, the small town American life.
Yeah, that's a great answer.
So, but there's also this kind of I don't know exactly what the word is, but you know how it teases the concept, like sort of makes fun of the concept of lessons being learned throughout the whole book. There's all these scenes all the time where, you know, some lesson's going to be learned from the book or whatever, or from something Anne's doing or reading. And then you get this section, or it's a little paragraph in the section that we read for this episode, where it's at the end of the Boat Springs Leaks scene. And Anne says, I think my prospects of becoming sensible are brighter now than ever. And Marilla says, I don't see how. And then Anne explains, I've learned a new and valuable lesson today. Ever since I came to Green Gables, I've been making mistakes. And each mistake has helped cure me of some great shortcoming. The affair of the amethyst brooch cured me of meddling with things that didn't belong to me. The haunted woods mistake cured me of letting my imagination run away with me. The liniment cake mistake cured me of carelessness in cooking. Dying my hair cured me of vanity. I never think about my nose and hair and nose now, well, at least very seldom, and today's mistake is going to cure me of being too romantic. I have come to the conclusion that it is no use trying to be romantic in Avonlea. So on the one hand, it's like a humorous sort of, you know, anecdote. On the other hand, I'm curious if, like, is it, do you think, given all the things that we're talking about, how do you think that the book's approach to the idea of, like, not necessarily moralizing, but the lessons that people can get from reading play out? I just said a sentence.
Try that again, David.
Well, I'm just
not sure that I follow.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm not sure that I follow either. That's why I'm asking a question that I've never thought about before. Okay, so we were talking about this idea that what Lucy Maud Montgomery is offering is an idealized life, and that that it might be something worth pursuing to some degree or another. And it's, you know, there are models in it that are valuable. Is that what you're saying, Heidi? At least partly. Okay. Uh-huh. So yeah. Now, on the other hand, the book seems to sort of make fun of things like Anne's romanticism, and it seems to make, you know, it celebrates her imagination, but also sort of teases her about it, if you will. And then it also makes fun of, maybe a little bit more directly, the idea of moralizing stories, while at the same time having Anne constantly talking, well, not constantly, but talking here at least, about the idea that she's learning all these lessons. So is she saying that these lessons that she's learning are part of that idealized way of life, that in this idealized way of life, these experiences that you have lead to lessons learned? Or is she subverting that and saying that, like, that's not really how life works, that's not really how these stories work, like the idea of lessons and morals is not nonsense, but not really the point of the experiences that we have. So I guess the concept of morals and lessons, is that, how does that factor into this concept of the world that Lucy Maud Montgomery is creating being an idealized world? Did that make more sense, Tim?
Right.
I think so.
We can move on.
No, I think it's a good question. That's why we're taking a minute to think about it. I do think that Montgomery's romantic, capital R, romantic vision of the world is very intentionally cultivated and intentionally portrayed. In the same way that, and it is in many ways analogous to Wendell Berry, in the same way that the Port William life is, like, true to life, that could happen, but it's also not the common American small town experience. It's what could be. And we, those who love Barry, become so attached to it that they create that, right? They cultivate it. They're like, I'm not just going to go move to a small town and just wait for it to do its work on me. Mm. You have to build it. That's a life you have to build intentionally. It doesn't happen to you. And that, I think, is the same invitation that that Montgomery is issuing in the Anne of Green Gables series. Is, if you just move to Prince Edward Island and adopt an orphan, you're not going to live this life.
Or if you're an orphan, you're not, with a good imagination.
Yes, yeah. Yes, exactly. But if you have a vision for the transformation of imagination, for the redemptive power of relationship, for what it means to live in a community and live in an ordinary life, even if you're an extraordinary person, you can build that. That's something you can cultivate. The same way you cultivate a garden, the same way you cultivate a farm, the same way you, but it takes work. It's not something that happens to you. And it comes out of a vision. And I think this is fiction that's inviting people to do that. And in that sense, there is a moralism to it. But I don't think she wants it to be just escapism, the same way Wendell Berry doesn't want you to read his books and treat it as escapism. He's saying, I know this is hard work. It's worth doing.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, the real only dissonance I have with this book that I've been trying to work through is this question that I'm asking, because there's these different commentaries on the concept of lessons learned in stories and moralism. Like, you'll have, you know, different characters are saying different things about it, from Rachel to
Miss Allen or whatever to the teachers, to the way Anne thinks about them, thinks about themselves. And I've been trying to jive this, you know, this idea of to look at all these stories for their, like to look at any story for its moral lesson is a sort of idealism. It's like kind of that's it's a sort of because it's suggesting that, you know, this thing has something for all people to learn that can help people change their lives, right? And that's a sort of like, I don't mean idealism in necessarily in a negative way, but that's a sort of idealism about the nature of stories, right? And so I've been trying to, but like I also find that this book has a has treated the concept in a number of different ways, and it's hard for me to track exactly what the book is saying about all that. Because I really like what you're saying about the idea that this is an ideal, an aspirational way of life, right? That with a little bit of intentionality, you can pursue parts of it and then perhaps achieve some element of it, although not all of it. But I've been trying to, that's just been a point of dissonance, which is why I can't explain what I'm trying to say.
I had this thought. I wonder if you guys can help me kind of tease this out. Part of my enjoyment of this book is that I think that Lisa Maud Montgomery has this kind of, she does not fear flux and change. I'll just say I kind of probably have a prejudice that I've tried to kind of rid myself from, that maturity or adulthood is this sort of fixed state that we're all trying to reach. It's like the ideal that we're trying to reach. But it's part of kind of like growing in wisdom is recognizing, well, no. And yes, we have an ideal and there's like a mature state that we want to achieve, a state of wisdom and virtue. But there's also just a joy to be had in the present state that one is in. And so this episode from Anne, it's sad that Anne is growing up. And so it makes me celebrate the fact that she was younger and that she was just full of energy and a little bit out of control, but she just brought so much color and life to Avonlea. And that was worth celebrating in and of itself. But there's this other aspect of her, which is, yeah, she has to grow up. We want her to grow up. We want her to be mature and wise. And we don't want her to have to kind of like learn the same lessons that cause her pain. We don't want her to have to learn them over and over and over. And so to kind of be able to embrace that there's this tension in every human life between like just the present state of maturity and all the foibles that go along with, let me say it a different way, the present state of kind of immaturity, of just youthfulness, that there's so many joys associated with that. Like I think of my god kids and my friends, the Maedas, they have like seven kids and their kids are like all across the spectrum of the ages. And they're delightful from the youngest to the oldest. They're delightful. And they're not just the youngest of them adults in waiting. You know, that's not who they are. They're actually part of the joy of being around them is that they're young and they're different and they have energy and they're learning and they're inventive and they have all these things that oftentimes ebbs away during adulthood.
Yeah.
And to be able to kind of celebrate, I think this book celebrates both that Anne is growing up and she has a trajectory and she's learning from it, but it also celebrates the fact that her youthfulness was like a balm to Marilla, to Matthew, to basically everybody she comes in contact with.
So what you're describing there, I think is helping me figure out what my problem was, is because so the scene that I just read, where she kind of distills the lessons of all these scenes that we got in the book, it seems to me to oversimplify and diminish what you're talking, the sort of balm that was her imagination. Because it says, basically Anne's saying, all the stuff that I went through, you know, that you're saying rightly was her, was the balm for the community, like for Matthew and Marilla, you know, her imagination brought a sort of healing. But here yeah. Anne distills all those adventures into the lessons she learned from them. And what I can't figure out is Anne's distillation doing that? Is that her trying to grow up? And that sometimes when we're growing up, we look at the things that we did wrong and we turn them into moral lessons, or is the book distilling that and diminishing what has been for a balm so long?
That's a great question.
Into them. And that's where my dissonance is coming up in the questions that I'm asking. Oh, because it was like moderately disturbing to me.
That makes a lot of sense.
And I couldn't really figure out why. And so here on the show, I'm doing that out loud. But the way you put it, that Tim, the concept that for so long, this young girl was this healing agent in the community and certainly in Matthew and Marilla's lives. It was a balm, as you said. And then she looks at those adventures and the only thing she has to say about them now is, you know, she basically looks at them as negative things that she had to go through to learn these lessons. But they weren't negative things. Maybe the individual moments themselves were a little negative. But when you look at them as a whole, Marilla herself expresses that she's going to miss those things.
Yeah.
They're fundamentally positive things. Like at their core, they're inherently good events that happened, even if they were born out of her mischievous imagination. Because it's not like we're talking about how she poisoned anybody. Well, although she did kind of. But it's not like they're actually like, you know, there weren't immoral things that she then learned a lesson and became a better human being. They were
right.
The actions of an overimaginative girl who got into a little bit of trouble. You know, there's a big difference there. And then those things get distilled into lessons. And that's sort of disturbing for me. So and then back to my question, is the book saying that, or is this the way what Aunt Maturity is doing for Anne? And either way, it's sad.
Right.
Unless there's a third way.
But she does continue to have all of those things as character flaws that add nuance into the books. And it's funny that you're saying that, because I've always just kind of skimmed over that as Anne just talking the way she does. Like, I've never taken that scene that you just read as a thesis statement of any kind, or a kind of a wrap up of the lessons of the book. I even as a child, like, I never moralized that. I just saw it as like Anne again, just talking and kind of in a silly, endearing way, saying something that she's trying to work her way through. Right. And
so you're saying that it's a bad job of reading by me, is what you're saying?
No, I don't think it's a bad job of reading by you, but I don't think that the story as a whole treats that as some kind of wrap up of her, putting a little bow on all of the lessons she's learned. But I do think it's likely, and you saying this illuminates this for me in a way I haven't paid attention to. I think it's likely that those anecdotes were intended, you know, those were beads on a string intended to kind of bring to the reader's attention an aspect of Anne and encapsulated in this chapter. She is careless, and I'll put that in the liniment cake episode. I want my readers to know that, right? Mm-hmm. And so that does make sense to me that each of those chapters kind of deals with a different flaw in Anne or something that she's learning. Yeah. But as we know, at this point in the novel, she is still vain. She still has a bad temper. She is still careless and abstracted and dreamy and too romantic and self-indulgent and all of those things.
Yeah.
So she didn't really learn her lessons.
So in some ways, though, would you agree that it does seem like, you know, Marilla is basically saying, why don't you grow up? Or when will you ever grow up? Let's just put it that way. And Anne is basically saying, well, look, I have learned these lessons, therefore I am growing up. So maybe it's just that Anne, in her mind, being immature, she thinks of maturity as the like a list of lessons you learn.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Maybe, so, okay. All right. Maybe. So yeah, I just was doing a bad job of reading. You're right.
Or David, maybe you, if you were seeing in the end of the book that possibly the book was going to say, oh, guess what? This story is a moral tale after all. You thought it was about the delight of this young orphan who's come to a stodgy town in a stodgy family, and she brightened the place up. That's what you thought you were reading, but you're actually reading a moral tale. I think that would be a legitimate complaint against the book. I don't think that's what the book is going to do in the end. That's
right. I'm not necessarily complaining about the book. I'm just saying for me, there was a dissonance in what it was.
There is a dissonance
in the way that it was talking or thinking about the idea of morals and lessons and correlation to maturity. Far be it for me to accuse Lucy Maud Montgomery of not knowing what she's doing. I'm not trying to say it's a flaw in the book. It's just that, you know, as a reader, it was a dissonance that you were helping me work out on the air.
Yeah.
We should probably start wrapping up. Do either of you have any passages or final comments that you want to offer before we dive into this last section for next week?
I'll say two things. I am sad that the book is coming to a close. This book has really grown on me. And I'm really curious if we're going to have any sort of resolve with guilt or if that's going to be put off to a later book. I'm very curious about that. I think we'll get something. I just don't know how final the resolution will be.
Heidi?
I want to comment on her relationship with Miss Stacy, which is a big, there's a lot in this book about education.
Yeah.
There's actually just so many, there really are so many layers to this book, about people, about relationships, about what it means to love. And one of the contemplations, one of the threads that runs through this book is education. We had Mr. Phillips, who is a bad teacher, and now you have Miss Stacy, who is a good teacher. Even in the Lily Maid scene, one of the things I love about it is their attachment to the
poem. Do you mean the Boat Springs a Leak scene?
Yes, the Boat Springs a Leak scene. Yes. I said it wrong. See, we both read poorly.
The Lily Maid scene? That's probably the actual name that it should be called, but I'm
Boat Springs and Lake.
I'm going to Boat Springs and Lake just for the rest of my life. I'm
all right. Well, let me say that over again. In the Boat Springs and Lake scene, sweet show swag, that is all hard to say.
Yeah.
They are so attached to this poem, and it makes the comment about how the poem has been parsed and almost to death, and yet still it has captured their imagination with the characters. And that's kind of the last vestige left of the true imaginative spark that comes through poetry. And so there's just all of these different threads that have to do with what it means to educate a soul. Through reading and through nature and through imagination and play acting and all those things that in this particular section that we read, we're getting some commentary on it, not just the story of it happening, but we're seeing how it's actually forming Anne in her soul. And I really like that.
There's in one of the chapters, sorry, I don't know which one it was. It says,
but it was a jolly, busy, happy, swift-flying winter. Schoolwork was as interesting, class rivalry as absorbing as of yore. New worlds of thought, feeling, and ambition, fresh, fascinating fields of unexplored knowledge seemed to be opening out before Anne's eager eyes. Hills peeped o'er hill and Alps on Alps arose. Much of this was due to Miss Stacy's tactful, careful, broad-minded guidance. She led her class to think and explore and discover for themselves and encouraged straying from the old beaten paths to a degree that quite shocked Mrs. Lynde and the school trustees, who viewed all innovations on established methods rather dubiously. Apart from her studies, Anne expanded socially from Marilla, mindful of the Spencervale's doctor's dictum, no longer vetoed occasional outings. The debating club flourished and gave several concerts. There were one or two parties almost verging on grown-up affairs. There were sleigh drives and skating frolics galore. between times Anne grew, shooting up so rapidly that Marilla was astonished one day when they were standing side by side to find the girl was taller than herself. "Why, Anne, how you've grown," she said almost unbelievingly. A sigh followed on the words. Marilla felt a queer regret over Anne's inches. That's that one page or whatever, I think is a really nice distillation of growing up at this point in your life and the things that a good teacher does for you and the way that a good teacher can create an environment that allows you to grow in a really healthy way, in a way that's surprising, you know, that you people look at it later and you're like, whoa. But that doesn't happen if the seeds haven't been planted, if the soil is not good. And Miss Stacy and Marilla have both clearly cultivated good soil. So I personally really liked that the scene it includes Miss Stacy there and then ends with Marilla, because I think together they're the ones that have enabled that growth in Anne. Matthew too, but you know, putting Miss Stacy and Marilla together, I think is a really nice bit there by Lucy Maud Montgomery. But I didn't mean to hijack your final thought there. That passage just sprang to mind when you were talking about it.
That was perfect. It was really good.
You can keep going on it though. I just want
to... No, that's all I had to say.
Okay. Well, that would be my final thought then.
Perfect.
Well, next week we will talk about the end of the book, and then the next week we will do the Q&A. So as I said, be ready with your questions. You can start emailing them to us now if you'd like, closereadspodcast@gmail.com, and then we'll have the thread over on the Facebook page as well. All right. Well, with that, for Heidi White, for Tim McIntosh, I am David Curran. Thanks so much for listening. Talk to you next week. And until then, happy reading.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.